This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Kara Miller. In 2008, after our economy went into free fall, the Great Recession was declared officially over thanks to major government bailouts. But on the ground, in our day-to-day lives, the recession can feel very much alive, with the economy sluggish and 12 million people still dealing with having to look for a job. So what will it take to get things back on track? And what were the underlying forces that got us here in the first place? Joining me to talk about this is Mike Konzall. He's a fellow at the Roosevelt Institute who writes about financial reform, and his piece for the November edition of Boston Review is titled Sweet Forgiveness. Mike Konzall, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So let me first ask you about, you know, you talk about debt being generally the result of overspending, and we think, look, if you're $10,000 in credit card debt, that's $10,000 that you should not have put on your credit card. But you say when it comes to the housing bubble, that's not exactly true, that you've got a bunch of sort of delinquent people out there.
Well, right now, we have about $1 trillion, depending on how you measure it and what you're including, in underwater mortgage debt. This is debt where it's the value of the debt is greater than the home. So this makes it difficult for people to move. It makes it difficult for housing markets to clear. But crucially, for the point of view of the recession and the recovery, it means that people are pulling back on spending for a variety of reasons. They're nervous about their mortgages. They're trying to pay down debts. They have certain credit constraints kick in. And as a result of that huge decline in aggregate spending, there's mass unemployment, and the economy has had a really sluggish recovery as a result.
Okay. And so, and this could, in a way, sneak up on somebody. So if you have a $300,000 house, or a house that you believe to be worth $300,000, and you take out a $240,000 mortgage, and then all of a sudden somebody says, oh, actually, it's only worth $200,000, but you've got this $240,000 mortgage, it's going to change the way you live your life, isn't it?
Absolutely. Both in practical terms, like you have to actually pay down that debt and you're going to be nervous about it. But then in just, you know, more macroeconomic terms, you know, the fact that everyone starts to pull back on spending all at the same time, especially when the government doesn't step in, and we'll talk a little bit about that later, means that there's, you know, less money being spent, which means you might lose your job or you might not get a pay raise, which means you're more indebted because the value of your income has declined even further. And so then you're more nervous. And this is a self-perpetuating cycle. You know, it's called the paradox of thrift when John Maynard Keynes diagnosed it during the Great Depression.
So part of it is just feeling you feel like you are less rich. And we saw the reverse of it during the dot-com bubble, where people went out and spent because on paper, they felt like they had money to spend.
Absolutely. And the debt constraint is even harder because during the tech bubble, you know, when the tech bubble collapsed, everything was pretty much figured out within about a year or two in terms of, you know, what companies were worthless, who lost their money, and crucially, who was going to eat those losses. It's been 5 or 6 years since the end of the housing bubble, and we still have housing markets that are having mass foreclosures, bad mortgages that we don't know what's going to happen to, and a housing market that's really holding back the economy from achieving liftoff.
Now, what is your sense? We heard a lot about this a year or two ago, but what is your sense of the magnitude of the problem of people simply walking away from homes and from mortgages, like you said, homes that are underwater, where they owe more on the house than it's worth?
In general, that's not a large number of the people who are being foreclosed on or people who have essentially stopped paying. You know, some estimates say about an eighth of people, maybe about 10 to 20%. Those numbers are a little weird because they tend to include people who are still making, you know, credit card payments or car payments, but not their house, which, you know, if you have a real income problem, you would want to make your car payment first because you need your car to go look for a job or try to work a job. So in general, it's not a big problem. If anything, it's probably a bigger problem that people are tapping savings, tapping their kids' college funds, tapping 401ks to try to make payments on a house that they simply can't afford on mortgage debt that's really gone bad.
So they're kind of borrowing the future from the future to pay for a present that in a lot of senses is throwing good money after bad.
Exactly. I mean, you had the housing market collapse roughly 50% in a few year period. This is not a story about irresponsible borrowers. I mean, there are people who took out mortgages that they shouldn't have gotten. There are lenders who lent that they shouldn't have lent. But, you know, if you made a solid mortgage, you know, 20% down and housing drops 50%, you're in a lot of trouble. And that's just a matter of, like, the timing of the market. It had very little to do with your individual decision.
Now, you say that one of the things that the Federal Reserve and Ben Bernanke has done is that they've tried to break the cycle here. And the way that that they've tried to do it is say, okay, well, we're just going to really, really lower interest rates, which does a whole bunch of things, including maybe make refinancing your home easier. But that has had a lot of unintended consequences. Like what?
Well, the big problem is that they hit something called the zero lower bound. So in general, the Fed can kind of, you know, steer the economy one way or the other, but it can step on the accelerator of the economy. Let's use that metaphor, right? You know, it steps on the accelerator and the brake. However, to keep the metaphor going, you'd have to push the accelerator through the floor of the car relative to how bad the housing crash slowed down aggregate demand. You'd have to have set interest rates at -5 or -6%, which you can't physically do at the Federal Reserve. So Ben Bernanke and other FOMC members have tried alternatives to do other ways to boost the economy through monetary policy, but it's very untested. I think they've done an admirable job, and they could be doing a lot more. I think they've finally stepped up to the responsibility in the past 6 months. But, you know, the crash was so bad, the normal mechanism we use to ensure full employment and that the economy is growing was essentially put on the sideline.
Now, let me put in a sort of contrary argument here, and you can take issue with it. Some people might say, look, if you look at housing prices in the last few months, these seem to be rebounding. People generally follow this Case-Shiller index, which tracks housing prices in different markets all over the country and tries to figure out, are more people buying houses and what are they buying them at? And we've seen it doing pretty well in the last few months. Is it possible that if we wait it out, housing is going to rebound and the people who are dealing with tough situations right now with underwater mortgages may be saved by a better economy?
Well, that's certainly the path we're likely to be on. So let's hope it works. One is that this is really in part a diagnosis of 2010 to 2012, right? Which by all accounts should have had a much faster and much more vigorous recovery, which did not. And we think housing debt, and I think the Academy's view of the data is starting to come into line. And the piece I wrote for Boston Review summarized a lot of the research that is currently being debated by leading economists. You know, there's housing certainly looks to have hit a bottom, and it's starting to rebound a bit. There's a lot of problems still out there, though. There's still a lot of underwater mortgages, which will have a difficult time selling. There are certain tax rebates that helped grease the wheels of short sells and people writing down mortgage debt that are set to expire at the end of the year, which may not be renewed. You have a lot of poor income growth, especially with young people who we need to purchase the starter home so people with underwater starter homes can buy, you know, more mature and larger homes. And, you know, youth unemployment is very bad. So I am optimistic about the next 2 years with housing, but I'm not a cheerleader on it. I think there's a lot of problems before we get out of the woods.
Okay, let's talk about then what you think we should do in terms of policy solutions. Right as we start that, I want to play a clip for you that will probably be familiar. This is CNBC correspondent Rick Santelli. He's standing in the bond pits in Chicago in early 2009. And this is actually the initial complaint that the Tea Party latched onto. And what he's really talking about here is, look, if you can't afford to pay for the stuff that you signed on to pay for, i.e. your mortgage or credit card debt, we're not going to help you out. Let's listen.
You know, the government is promoting bad behavior because we certainly don't want to put stimulus forth and give people a whopping $8 or $10 in their check and think that they ought to save it. And in terms of modifications, I'll tell you what, I have an idea. You know, the new administration's big on computers and technology. How about this, President and new administration? Why don't you put up a website to have people vote on the internet as a referendum to see if we really want to subsidize the losers' mortgages? Or would we like to at least buy cars and buy houses in foreclosure and give them to people that might have a chance to actually prosper down the road and reward people that could carry the water instead of drink the water?
Hey,
we're thinking of having a Chicago Tea Party in July. All you capitalists that want to show up to Lake Michigan, I'm going to start organizing.
What are you jumping in?
I'm Kara Miller. This is WGBH Boston Public Radio, and we're talking to Mike Konzol, a fellow at the Roosevelt Institute, who wrote the piece Sweet Forgiveness in Boston Review. And Mike Konzol, when you hear Rick Santelli from 2009 saying, look, I don't want to subsidize the losers' mortgages, what do you think?
Yeah, the loser's phrase is just really powerful there, right? Because that's how a certain – there's a certain view that thinks it that way, right? Like that the important part about the economy is that it punishes people who make the bad decisions. As we talked about earlier, you know, a lot of people – you put down a 20% down mortgage in 2005 and then your house collapsed 40 or 50% in value. It's tough to think that you were behaving irresponsibly. I mean, buying a home is very much part of the middle class package in this country. In practice, what we've seen is, you know, we haven't actually had a very aggressive form of debt relief. What Santelli was ranting about was something called HAMP, which in general was seen as a very mild proposal that kicked the can down the road on a lot of these hard decisions about foreclosures or about housing debt. But, you know, what we've seen is millions of foreclosures. And, you know, if you want to talk about something that really harms people who were, you know, quote unquote, behaving responsibly, seeing a neighborhood destroyed by foreclosures, which you can, you know, go to parts of Boston, parts of New York, parts of any major city, and even some smaller cities, you can find neighborhoods that are just blighted by huge foreclosures, which destroy property values, increase the cost of municipalities, make it very, you know, increase crime, make it very hard to provide public services. This policy of trying to deal with the problem through foreclosures is a bad one, both because it has these huge costs for people, but then it also exacerbates the problem because it drives down housing prices even more, well below their value, and then, you know, causes even more underwaterness, which causes even more of a, you know, sluggish recovery.
Now, part of the Rick Santilli rant was, look, we're not going to help out the moochers. And that really helped, as you could hear at the end. He said, let's have a tea party, right, which is where the Tea Party got its name. Do you think that the view of the American public has changed enough that people would now be willing to listen to an argument like yours, which might be, you know, maybe instead of just leaving these people on their own, we should have a different approach?
So, I mean, there's three major approaches. One is to actually just try to drive through to full employment through fiscal stimulus and through the Federal Reserve, what we should normally do. That's been insufficient. Republicans have blocked additional stimulus measures in the House and the Senate, and the Federal Reserve has kind of been timid up until recently. But if you look at the housing market, what people are really proposing are things like bankruptcy and mass refinancing. So, you know, to allow someone to refinance their home at ultra low rates right now, which they can't do because they're underwater, you know, those are people who want to stay in their homes or people who really, you know, they want to fight for their communities, want to fight for their identity as homeowners. And this is the ability to use the ultra low rates we have right now in the capital markets to give them more purchasing power. It's a really fantastic form of stimulus. Bankruptcy has been, you know, it's in the Constitution that Congress can make bankruptcy laws. Bankruptcy has been a time-tested means of allocating losses when things go bad. Things have gone terribly bad in the housing market. And, you know, this bankruptcy would help people with the most debt who would, in fact, want to stay in their homes and keep, you know, people in their homes and their communities. Bankruptcy is a really useful form of that. You know, there are a lot of other mechanisms that duplicate those two ideas, but those aren't really, you know, rewarding irresponsibility. They're trying to make sure people have money in their pockets and also communities to build.
Is there a way of figuring out who gets mortgages forgiven or help and who doesn't? I mean, it seems the problem with something like this is it seems like, well, there's a broad spectrum, right? And some people are underwater by to the tune of $20,000 and other people to the tune of $200,000. Some people have potentially the means to pay back their mortgage or a portion of it. Other people just completely don't and are currently unemployed and are dealing with other fallouts of the recession. How do you really implement on a serious level some of this forgiveness?
Sure. So two possible proposals, right, that just to keep them in the framework we just discussed. Bankruptcy, you have to go before a judge, and it's actually a pretty painful procedure. So the people who would want to do it are the people most in need of it, and they would have consequences as a result of that action. Their credit score would take a huge hit. So we'd like to think that bankruptcy, and bankruptcy code is plastic. We could pass laws to make it do different things. There you'd have a good filter on people who really do need forgiveness versus people who are just trying to skim. When it comes to refinancing loans, we'd want everyone to participate because we want everyone, you know, everyone who is not underwater can refinance their loans because of a variety of laws and certain types of banking constraints. People who are deeply underwater have not been able to refinance. So that's actually something we'd want everyone to do because it reflects the fairness of them, you know, their payments reflecting the cost of actual mortgages and would help actually start to grease the wheels to get the economy going again. Crucially, the quicker we get to a point where the economy works for all, everyone is better off. So even though you may think someone is being rewarded for something you don't like necessarily, you know, the moment we take these burdens off the economy, we can start to grow again, get people employed, build, innovate, share, you know, and work jobs that are productive. And that ultimately will benefit everyone.
Now, anybody who has tried to refinance in the last few years knows that it's gotten a lot tougher. Partially, banks have realized they were too free with money a few years ago, and so they've tightened things up. Now, do you allow somebody to refinance who owes, oh, I don't know, $240,000 on a $200,000 house, i.e. they owe more than the house is worth? What do you do for that specific case, let's say?
Well, you can do things like something called HARP, which the Obama administration has significantly expanded this year and I think has been a pretty good success, which means that you allow people underwater to refinance with the government taking some of that risk. Crucially, if someone is deeply underwater, there's a good chance that they could stop paying and be foreclosed on. That's often because places with the most underwaterness have the highest unemployment rates. If you refinance them, they have some more money in their pocket, which means, crucially, they have a little bit more buffer in case things go bad to continue making their mortgage payments. So what you find in a lot of these studies, and the GSEs have done them, when you allow for refinancing and sometimes even for principal reduction, you have safer, better loans that are less likely to default. So it's actually a better deal for both parties. Now, it's often tough to determine, you know, who needs those and who really doesn't, which is why the refinancing is something that's the first step people propose the most.
Now, if you're an executive sitting in a corner office at a bank and you've got a lot of loans out there, how do you think about the pros and the cons of, you know, forgiving debt, allowing people to refinance who maybe you normally wouldn't allow to refinance? How do you think the banks are dealing with this situation?
Well, I mean, you can see, so people who are trapped, it's some technical finance stuff here, but just broadly speaking, people who are trapped underwater sell at a premium on the secondary markets, which means that people actually really want people who are underwater because they can't refinance. So, you know, they're funded, you know, rates are very low. They're very low for the government. They're very low for the mortgage markets. But people are trapped into these rates that are significantly higher, 6, 7, 8 plus that were, you know, in 2005 when, you know, there was money was a lot tighter. And so they're paying this huge premium over the market rate. So as a bank executive or as a creditor broadly, you don't actually really want them to refinance because you feel that, you know, if they're going to make payments, especially up front, you're going to do pretty well. So that's one problem. The second problem is you often have multiple creditors, people who, say, have the primary loan and then people have a secondary loan or a home equity line of credit on a mortgage, very popular in the housing bubble. Those people are often in very different places, and it's very difficult to them to coordinate. So one might want to write down mortgage debt, but that would only help the other person. So they both have to kind of, you know, hold hands and write down debt together. Bankruptcy is the normal mechanism for coordinating creditor behavior, but bankruptcy is out of play because it's not allowed to take effect on primary mortgages.
So you think people, executives of banks might be saying, look, we've got these people, even though they may be underwater on their homes, we've got them pretty much right where we want them, paying 6, 7, 8% on a mortgage. Maybe that's not sustainable, but your sense is, it doesn't sound like the banks are saying, oh, sure, let's let them refinance so that they really can pay us for the next 10, 20, 30 years on their mortgage.
I mean, it's a conflict between, I mean, they're both things are in play, right? So you have people who, you know, they have a pretty sweet deal here. You know, a lot of them were bailed out by the government, so they're not too worried about falling apart in the immediate near future. And, you know, there's a lot of regulatory forbearance about their books and how good these mortgages actually are. And then there's also a real big coordination problem for a lot of these banks where they would all ideally like to write down some debt, but they can't. They all have to do it at the same time, else, you know, the people who hold out are going to get a really sweet deal because someone else will write down debt, and so the rest of the debt's much better. Tackling both problems is it's just essential that the government takes a role in this. You know, we can't think that just because housing prices are coming up a little bit that, you know, we're going to get out of this recovery in time to really, you know, start to create jobs on a much quicker timescale.
Now, are there people in Congress? Are there people in the White House? I mean, you talked a little bit about President Obama's programs to allow people to refinance. Do you think that on a broad scale, this idea of allowing people to reconfigure their debt so that they're not in a kind of debtor's prison is going to gain traction? Is it really going to, you know, become part of what we allow in the country?
I mean, you know, Congress is obviously gridlocked for quite some time, and most of the focus is going to be on kind of artificial constraints like the debt ceiling or, you know, the fiscal cliff that they created for themselves. I think what you're noticing is a lot of top economists and also top economists associated with the Obama administration are realizing that they really messed up by not addressing the housing market earlier and more forcefully. You're starting to see a lot of public quotes, you're starting to see a lot of public forums, and you're starting to see a lot of research. So I think you're going to see the consensus move among people who try to watch this very closely and try to come up with policy solutions. How that enacts into actual policy enacted by Congress, I don't think anyone can say.
And finally, and there's been some stuff written about this, and you mentioned it yourself. Talk a little bit about the debt collection process and this idea of a 21st century debtor's prison, which some of us may not see, but it's amazing how much more kind of vicious debt collectors have become in recent years.
Sure. So, you know, a very common thing people are worried about is you have a lot of really shady fly-by-night debt collection agencies. So they'll, you know, send out a notice for a debtor or someone who's missed payments to appear in court, and they just kind of throw it away, or they don't actually do it, and they say they did. You know, that person doesn't show up at court. A bench warrant goes out, and they're arrested. And, you know, when they're arrested, their bail can be used to pay off the debts. So, you know, there's that is one of many types of examples where you're seeing the law come down a lot more harshly on debtors in favor of people who are owed debts.
And people end up, I was going to say, people end up having all sorts of things taken from them that you might not imagine that somebody could, you know, arrive at your house and take.
Absolutely. So the number of Americans who have had contact with a debt collector or so who are presumably behind on some debt has doubled from like 8% to 16% over, I think, the last 15 years or so. But it's, you know, it's something a lot more Americans are becoming familiar with, unfortunately. And, you know, that those systems are pretty, you know, pretty repressive. They're bad systems. And crucially, and you also see this in the mortgage market, there's all kinds of incentives to cheat on the side of the debt collectors. There's all kinds, as we said, you know, saying you've informed someone to appear in court and you didn't, saying you're going to fill out paperwork and not fill it out, saying you're going to verify documents under fiduciary responsibilities and you're not. That really needs regulation and really needs to be cleaned up, because that's something we've allowed to fester over the past couple decades, and it's only getting worse.
We've been talking about what it would take to end the Great Recession and how debt factors into this. And I've been speaking with Mike Konzol. He's a fellow at the Roosevelt Institute, an expert on financial reform, and his recent piece for Boston Review is titled Sweet Forgiveness. Mike Konzol, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Edgar Herwick, you're back again.
I am back again. Kara, so you're just talking about getting out of the recession, and I think spending is a key to getting out, and people spend
Definitely.
At the holiday season, right? Not just
yeah.
on presents, but also on things, going out and doing stuff.
Absolutely.
Like live music.
Yeah.
Are you going to go see any live music?
I don't know. So far, I've only seen the music on, which is very good, on the Charlie Brown Christmas special, but hopefully I will get out to,
All right, so, well, there's
to
a
see
lot of,
some live music.
A lot of concerts, a glut of concerts happening, and we're going to do a concert roundtable with some bona fide experts to talk about what are the best that are coming to town over
Excellent.
The holiday season.
Then I'll learn and I'll know
You'll
what
learn,
to,
you'll
go
know where to go
to.
There you go.
I'm Kara Miller.
I'm Edgar B. Herwick III, and you are listening to Boston Public Radio.